5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Croc podcast. This is Dr. Tommy and Ellie here, hoping to bring you a podcast full of hope, inspiration, and support. Joined by me today is, as always, Angel Santana. Have faith, let it begin. Angel, I want to say that I'm excited, and I am, of course, to have a dear guest and a special new friend. But the subject matter we're going to be talking about today is very serious. And we have our weeks where we're very light and airy, and we have our weeks where we're fun and joking around. And unfortunately, this will not be one of those podcasts.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the greatest things is that when we have a platform like this and are able to come together and share something that I think is going to touch many people's lives. And like we always say here, even if it's just one, we're going to do our fans and our Croc Nation justice.
Exactly. So what I try to do on the podcast, everyone, is I try to bring lessons from the clinic, things that have happened, things that have either shown themselves to be great lessons for us. We've done a couple of weeks where, our patients have schooled us, and today is no exception. However, an event happened about a month ago that really shook our clinic, our cancer center, very, very greatly. And that was the loss of a patient, but not from cancer, but rather by their own hand. And as I had said previously, there have been times in my career that we have lost patients to suicide. There have been times where patients just, the journey became too much for them. They were in pain. Death was imminent, and they decided that they wanted rest. And in those circumstances, although difficult to manage, that was one thing. But when we had a young, newly diagnosed person who came into our clinic very despondent, we really tried our best. We did all of our distress screenings, and we read the red flags correctly, and we tried to get the individual help, and it just didn't work. And that brought us, everybody in the clinic was absolutely devastated to have someone who had a very curable cancer and their life. And I'm, despite this terrible circumstance, we're going to turn it into a circumstance where some of our survivors, and we're going to designate some of the higher risk categories of our survivors, might have these feelings or thought about these feelings. And this is a safe place. This is a place where I hope that you can get the information you need if you are in trouble, or if you do feel that despair. Joining us today, Angel, is a dear, dear young lady, someone that I'm getting to know through my daughter's boyfriend's sister. Tara is a young lady, just graduated from Holy Cross College, University?
College. College of the Holy Cross.
College of, and I know in the McGuire family, that's a badge of honor. Yeah. That goes back generations, and Tara works for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She is the WALKS administrator, and I'll have her explain that. And I just wanted to take a minute and first welcome you, and Angel, I'm sure you would like to welcome her as well.
Absolutely. Welcome to the Croc Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here, and I think the first thing I want to say is I am so sorry for your loss as a clinician and the team that knew this person and their family and loved ones as they go through this. It is a journey to lose someone by suicide, and it's a lifelong process, but know that there is support out there. I am so excited to be here today. I think it's an important topic because the more we talk about suicide and mental health, the more people feel comfortable and willing to share how they're feeling each and every day. So I am the WALKS Administrative Assistant, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and I'm out of our national office in New York City, but we have about 75 chapters across the country. So we reach across all of America and even into Puerto Rico as of this year. So we are excited to continue to expand. And we are the largest funded research suicide prevention company out there. We are a nonprofit. We reach out to people both who are thinking and having suicidal thoughts, people that have made breakthroughs through their thoughts and are now living as attempt survivors, and also our lost survivors, which is our community of people who have lost someone by suicide. So that's a little bit about the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I can deep dive into it more if you have anything that you
want. Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there's a couple things that came out. Number one is that, you know, not being in the mental health game, I know in medical school, they taught me about a million years ago that it is okay to talk to someone about suicide. And, you know, and I think that it kind of goes against the grain in the sense that I think that we are still a very puritanical society. I still think we're a very maybe superstitious society. And I think we don't want to put thoughts into someone's head. You know, that's the naive part of our brain. But I think the data is actually very clear that you're not going to put an idea in someone's head. That idea is already there. And maybe it would be productive to get them to talk about it.
100%. It saying suicide, asking someone how they feel does not mean that they are going to have suicidal ideation or thoughts about suicide. It actually most often decreases the risk of it, and they feel like they're more open and comfortable. I think there's a few things. It's really important to talk about suicide safely. So the first thing is most people who aren't comfortable with suicide and talking about it often say committed suicide when talking about losing someone. And that is something that we really want to stay away from, because committed is connected to crimes and suicide being a criminal action. And, you know, even until the 60s, in some places, it was still criminal offense to commit suicide. And we want to destigmatize that by saying died by suicide. You know, death by suicide is hard, but it's not as hard as any other death. Losing someone's always going to be hard. So we need to normalize it. And I think committed is a big thing when people aren't comfortable, often rely on that language. And the more we get away from that, the better the conversations are going to be. Also,
That's awesome. I agree. So how would you recommend, even as a doctor who's, you know, sees a million patients, what would be a good segue? I know the nurses do their distress screenings and all those types of things, but is there just I notice, Mr. Smith, that you seem very despondent. You know, how are you feeling? Do you feel depressed? And, you know, just sort of let them kind of roll with it, kind of that type of thing.
Yeah, I think it goes to something that is natural. Like, we can never ask someone how they're feeling enough. I feel like a lot of people's response with like, good, I'm fine is like the biggest sign for me. I feel like it's a lot of people's natural like reaction. But when I ask someone how they're doing, I want to know how they're doing. How is their day going? What are they dealing with? And I think that's an easy way to kind of continue the conversation. If someone gives you like I'm fine, or it's just a bad day, you're completely allowed to have just a bad day, but often there's a lot more going on to that just a bad day, and they may just be feelings for a short period of time, but those feelings are valid. And a lot of times when we talk about mental health, someone will be like, just go to bed, sleep it off. And again, a lot of people can do that, but some people can't. And if they are having suicidal ideation, like hearing just sleep it off isn't good enough for them. It doesn't encourage them in the right ways. So a lot of times when talking to someone who may be struggling, validate their feelings is really important, to say like, I understand, especially in the terms of cancer patients, a lot is going on in their lives. And I have never been through cancer. I've had a loved one go through cancer treatment, and I can't even imagine what it felt like on their end. But I consistently always ask them, you know, how are you feeling? How are we going to get through this? And I wanted them to scream, cry, and say it all, because then I can say, amazing. Now I know how you're feeling and how we can go from here and how we can continue to work on these feelings. So I think a lot of it is, you can't downplay it, but you also, in a weird way, it's a delicate balance of, you don't want to play into it and be like, ah, like, I don't know how to help. There's so many resources out there. So I think once you open that conversation, it kind of, maybe some flags go off in your head and you're like, they probably do need some help. There are plenty of resources, and I can dive into that if you'd like to. Or
yeah, we'll get into that in a minute. I'm still picking your brain.
Yeah.
And that's no slim pickings. You got a lot of brains up there, young lady, a lot of gray matter. So I think the other thing that's I guess that dark box that generally people don't know about is, you know, the standing joke is, you know, the 1970s stand-up comedian would say, suicide hotline, please hold. And, you know, that's like, we think that, you know, suicide help is calling somebody on the phone. And it's not, because your society, although does have a resource based end to it, I think most of it is research, right? And you were telling me offline about all the great research you're doing as far as how to, you know, classify suicide, the different types and the reasonings. And then if you're able to do the science, I think you guys are actually doing the science, and that's what your fundraising is supporting. It's not just supporting, you know, a 1-800 number. It's also supporting the research to maybe make suicide, you know, a thing of the past.
A massive part of what we do, and we have a whole research team. I am no expert, but I am always curious about it, so I do know a little bit about not only what we do, but just what the community is talking about. But we really want to investigate what may lead someone to have suicidal ideation. There's multiple factors, and there's a lot of paths that can lead to someone dying by suicide or considering it or attempting it. And we're trying to figure out, how do we prevent that? How do we enable communities to recognize that? How do we support people during that? Like, when you come up with and recognize and acknowledge those feelings of suicidal ideation, where do we go from there? We are constantly trying to evolve that. And then also something that we're newly exploring is, when you lose someone, how does that impact you as a loss survivor? You know, it's a big change in everyone's life. And how can that actually manipulate your brain into future situations and how you deal with trauma and unpacking those feelings? So we do a lot. We have grants that we give out. It's actually Research October at our foundation, and we're really focusing on our new generation of researchers. We're really big into empowering new researchers, young undergrads that are curious about mental health and want to continue to push the boundaries. So we do a lot, and you can find it all on our website if anyone wants to deep dive there. There are years and years of research studies available if you go to afsp.org/research. That will bring you to everything that we have funded. So we only fund, we don't have the research on hand, but we go outside and we do it both in America and outside the country. So we can better understand, not only as a nation, how do we tackle this, but more as a world.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. Which, I guess it would be a Department of Psychiatry. What are some of the leading research institutions in our country?
NAMI, National Institute of Mental Health and Mental Illness, SAMHSA, Substance Abuse, they are really big, and we partner with them a lot. And those are the two big ones that come off my head. But obviously, there's places like the Trevor Project, which specifically focus on LGBTQ plus communities and their impact and how they are impacted by suicide. But those are probably our three big main categories, and, you know, people that we partner with. But the list goes on. There are so many places that are finally coming to a level where they can acknowledge suicide and acknowledge mental health being, you know, physical health and mental health, and that there's no health without either.
Absolutely. And just for our listeners, our survivors, a couple of statistics. So suicide is the 11th leading cause of death in this country. And sadly, and happily and sadly, it's going up approximately 1.7% per year in the general population, and happily decreasing about 2.8% in the cancer population. However, a cancer survivor has double the risk for suicide than the general population. So there's a lot of things associated with that. And when you're doing a literature review on a subject that Angel and I try to do before each podcast, We look at what's called a meta-analysis or an article which takes and goes through thousands and thousands of articles and tries to sort of squeeze out the important information. And the PubMed review basically has a 10-year, 24 resource, you know, a database where these numbers come from. So what are some of the red flags? What were the red flags that we saw in this particular patient? And what are some of the other red flags that might not be so notable? So in this particular case, this gentleman was self-professed to say when he was getting screened that he did have some thoughts that, you know, whether he wished to be alive or not. And that already, that's not just a red flag, that's a five alarm fire. You know, so that's like, you have to get to mental health ASAP. And in this case, it just happened to be that we did, but it wasn't enough. The other thing that was missing was, I don't think we dug deep enough to find out exactly why, as Tara said, you have to dig in and say, okay, I get it that you want to feel like, so many patients say to us, you know, boy, I'd rather be dead. You know, that could be construed as a suicidal ideation, but sometimes it's real and sometimes it's not. And what we didn't know in this particular case, again, a very curable cancer, was this patient didn't have the support of his family. They were a very religious family, which didn't believe in traditional medicine. And by him trying to achieve a cure through the traditional means, he was not garnering that support from his family. And he became so emotionally troubled about this that he chose a different way out. And I think that we missed that. We did everything right, but I don't think, I think that, you know, this was a great lesson to us. The other red flags that you wouldn't even think about is that males are four times more likely to commit suicide than females. So if we have a male survivor, that's something for us to put in the back of our heads. Also chronic illness, which cancer can be, depression, pain, which cancer can have, living alone, being isolated, or being unemployed could definitely also be some of these red flags that we look at. One of the reasons, actually, there's a trident of reasons of why I think suicide might be in the decline in cancer is because we have amped up our resources with patients that are, they're all survivors, whether it's your last day on earth or not, you're still a survivor. But some survivors who might be going toward the end of their disease, the end of their life, we now have other options besides, you know, just putting in an intravenous and giving them morphine. We have really a new specialty called palliative care, where we're able to address not just pain needs and things like that, but emotional needs and psychological needs and spiritual needs and those types of things. Hospice can be much better in the sense that hospice is a great organization, but underfunded. So as a result, hospice really should take patients, stage four terminal patients that have years and years to live early in their disease process rather than 2 weeks before they die. So that's one of the things in our organization in cancer game that's not working well. And the mental health resources, that's a mixed bag, because even though mental health resources are more now than they were just say 10 years ago, that's like saying, okay, you know, Las Vegas in 1927 had a slot machine, so they had gambling, and then 10 years later, they had two slot machines. It's better, but it's still not Las Vegas of what it is now. And we need like mental health to be Las Vegas now with the Bellagio and the Venetian and, you know, all of the, you know, all the free buffets. We need that for mental health, and we don't have that. I find it difficult. I find it so easy for me to get a referral to a doctor in Memorial who specializes in renal cell cancer, or to send somebody who has a, you know, leukemia, I'll send them somewhere in the city or whatever for a bone marrow transplantation. or I'll send a patient of mine who I don't have protons, I'll send them to the city to get protons. But God, I can't find a psychiatrist to send a patient to. They're just not there. So Tara, I wanted to kind of set the table on the cancer side and have you comment on my comments.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think when you talk about the referrals, I think one big thing is we should give credit to the system right now that there is a lot of changes. It may not be all of Las Vegas, but more slot machines are more slot machines, and we need to take that as a win. So as you mentioned, years ago, it wasn't that. And I think a lot of people, we fight the good fight every day. My team says it every day. We fight the good fight. And I know on the medical side, I imagine a similar sentiment is there as well of like, we have a big thing to tackle and we're doing our best to chip away at it, but we're not there yet. But that doesn't mean we can't celebrate the little wins. So I think, as you mentioned, having the palliative care that's more holistic of all different aspects of what life is for someone and addressing that. And whether it be a psychiatrist that's available, if there's just someone there, whether it's a nurse or someone on staff, a social worker who's willing to listen, that is a big step in what we know for in the healthcare system. As I mentioned, the person in my life that went through cancer, having her team available to her was a big part of her journey. And I know that it was helpful for her. And I think that's a big step and had helped her a lot. Your mentions of the statistics, they are staggering. But again, it not being in the top 10 right now as a cause of death in the top leading deaths, that's a big win for us. Our American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has a project called Project 2025, and we tried to reduce the rate of suicide by 20% by 2025. And this started, I want to say, about 15 years ago at our organization. We have made a lot of stride in that percentage of the leading cause of death and the amount of deaths by suicide each year. So again, may not be a 0% and may not be a world without suicide prevention, but we're getting there. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
No, you're doing amazing. As a matter of fact, I can't tell you how poised and how grateful we are for your information. Let me ask you this question while we have a little pause here. How about a number that patients can call?
Yes. So there has been a big transition in our field in the hotline number. Our new national hotline is 988. So if I were to ask you, I don't even know, do you know the old number?
No.
Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah, and that was a big problem. That was a big hurdle for our nation to get across, the fact that, you know, if someone intrudes your house, who do you call? 911, right off the bat. Yeah. I think even as young as first graders now in our educational system know if something is wrong in an emergency, who are you going to call? 911, three easy numbers. But it was never the same if you were in a mental health crisis. But now, as of July 2022, you can call 988 and you'll be connected to the national hotline. And when you call that, it will actually recognize where you are calling from and connect you to a local center to receive local help. And also, a big part of people dealing with suicide ideation, if you call 911 knowing that you're in a crisis before having 988, the number was, what was it? It was 1-800-273-2855. Now, if you are in a horrible state of mind and you just need to reach out for help, that number is not going to come quickly. And a lot of people don't even like to type in the word suicide into their search engines because they don't want people to track that they may have these feelings. And so it was actually preventing a lot of people from reaching out for help. So this is a big step in our world without suicide, our moving forward as a society, normalizing mental health. And if you are in crisis or if you know someone in crisis, you can also call 988 and refer them. So if I was worried about someone to a point where I think something may have happened or something will happen very shortly, I could call 988, get connected to someone and express my concern and have someone who's appropriately trained, and that's a key word right there, to go visit them and check in on them. Because a lot of times, again, before that 988 number came out in July, if you called 911 in crisis, a police officer was going to come. And as hard as we try to have everyone trained to work through crisis, you know, if you're in that state of mind, seeing a cop at your front door may not be a good sign for you, and you may not react appropriately in that situation. So there's a massive change. And then also, we also have a national texting line. So if you text TALK, T-A-L-K, to 741-741, you can also talk to a counselor via chat automatically, which is
unbelievable. Yeah. Such amazing information. Angel, what a poised young lady. What do you think?
You know, I'm sitting here and the first thing that goes through my mind, you know, as I see the interaction between the both of you and, you know, through Tara, is how often we've heard the word suicide, right? You know, but there's not really a greater awareness like what we just did today. And that awareness is growing. And I think that the way you articulated everything today put me in a position for my own platform, and I know Ianelli's platform, to create this awareness. But what I keep hearing is the same thing. It's listening. And that, and open lines of communication. So these open lines of communication creates awareness. We are listening. And, you know, you don't have to be that person that has that friend, you know, that is in need, but you do need to be aware of our surroundings and aware of the red flags, aware of the possibilities, and aware of our environment, because you just don't know what person or persons are going to need that 988 number, which I think is phenomenal. I have actually a question for you, that I if I may. What inspired you to go down this path? Because I have always said, on my platform, there is a reason why we're put on this earth. There's not an accident. You're not an accident by any means. You were given this treasure, I call this gift, to allow yourself to be there for other individuals in their time of need. I'm just curious, where and how did that even come about?
Yeah, so a little background on me. Around 10 years ago, I lost my dad by suicide. So when I was 14, I was in eighth grade, and I unfortunately came home from school one Friday and was given the news, and it altered my life as a young adult, especially as a child, on how to lose a parent. You know, we all know that one day our parents, our guardians, our protectors won't be here on with Earth on us anymore, but you never expect it to be so soon, let alone it be by suicide, especially about 10 years ago when the conversation wasn't as open. I didn't know about my dad's struggles, not only because I was young, just because, you know, those red flags, those conversations weren't happening. And that really shaped me into who I wanted to be and who I was at the moment. I didn't want to let the pain use me. And I came across this phrase just about a year ago, and it was pain that uses you or pain that you use. And there's a difference. We all encounter pain that will use us. There are just some days where life is tough. And I let myself have those days. I mean, 10 years into this journey, and I still have days where, you know, the heaviness in my heart, I just need to take a break and step away from things. And then there are days where I show up to work and I know I'm doing the right thing, and then I'm making the world a better place for others. But for me, I definitely had to go through that personal experience to find this passion. And I never want anyone to feel the way, not only that my dad did, but also as a survivor of loss. I carried a lot of guilt for a long time, especially at a young age, of how did I not realize? How did I not know? Like, how could I let myself be ignorant in a weird way of like about mental health, of that, you know, when dad didn't want to play catch with me, was it more than that? And there's a lot that goes into that of losing someone by suicide. The survivor guilt can be incredible and can often lead to people having their own suicidal ideations. And I am lucky enough that it did not get to me in that way, but I knew that I was lucky enough to have a platform, that I had this pain that I wanted to use. And what led me to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention was when I was a junior in high school, my aunt had heard a radio ad for the Overnight Walk, which is a part of our walk series that I now have the privilege of working on. And it is a walk that is 16 to 18 miles from dusk to dawn. So it's overnight from starting at 7 p.m. and we usually finish around 3:30 in the morning, and it changes cities every year. And it's a healing and hopeful event. You know, you never imagine that suicide would touch your life, but when you meet the people that it has touched, you realize that it's normal, that everyone has a story and everyone may be touched by it in different ways. Right off the bat on my loss, I felt like no one would understand, no one would get it. No one would feel like me or would have an experience like me. And then I went to this event with 1,500 people that had a shared connection with me. And that really set a fire within me of being like, I feel seen in a way in my life that I hadn't been like felt seen before. And I knew I needed to see it and see it through with other people. So then I went to college. I studied psychology and religious studies, and I had the privilege of interning with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, actually in their policy office. So not really related to psychology or religion, and more on how can we, through laws and through bills at the national and state levels, continue to improve this mental health conversation across the country. And that like inspired me further. And then coming to graduation, I just had this pull that I didn't want a 9-to-5 where I was excited to log off because I was sitting in a cubicle, plugging away at numbers, because that wasn't going to fill me and my soul. I wanted to be able to sit down every day and know that I was helping someone no matter what. And now I have the privilege of working for the foundation that helped shape my loss journey and my concept of how to talk about mental health and my approach in my everyday life on how I can influence others to be kind to themselves and to who they meet. And I have the privilege, that's all I can say. I feel honored that I get to do this work, and it came not easily. It's not an experience you ever wish on someone, but I'm happy that I can use this pain to help other people, and not just to save a life, but for other people to feel seen. Because that feeling I can feel every day when I talk to the walkers who we help and who help us by fundraising, getting on the phone each day with them and hearing, you know, their experience, or when someone, we also cater to those who have their own thoughts or have been attempt survivors, and hearing from them on their journeys and having the hope through the phone call. Oh, it makes me happy every single day. And you know, little 14-year-old Tara couldn't say the word suicide. I was terrified of it. I didn't want to tell people. I was ashamed. And it's not something that should be shameful. Because say if my dad had passed away by a heart attack, I wouldn't feel weird telling people that. It's death. Death is hard, but we can all work together to help each other through this.
Tara, there are no words that I can say that can truly accentuate what an amazing person you are and what a gift to humanity. The product of Brian and Ellie, you both should be very proud of this young lady. Angel, there are no words, so I'm not going to ask you for any.
Can I just say one thing, if you don't mind?
Sure.
Only because I would feel that it would not, it has to be said. A lot of times Dr. Yanelli will come to me for a spiritual, and I don't want to get too spiritual, but I'm just going to say this. I did an episode entitled "What is Your Gift?" And listening to you and your ability to humble yourself and share one of your most private moments, there is a thing that we call a glow. You shine. You shined before you spoke. There's something about you that is extremely inspiring. And hearing your story and knowing that there are people now going to listen and hear that story is only making my heart as a father of two more proud to know that there are people like you in this world. And finally, I would think that everybody will agree when I say that as a dad, if my daughter has just one piece of what you've expressed today, I would be totally, totally honored to have you as my daughter. And I know that I can probably say that there is that person in heaven who is looking down and saying, that's my daughter. So for that, I'm eternally grateful.
Yeah. If you're out there to our survivors and you have any of these feelings, I want to take this experience from this amazing man who we lost and try to reflect on the pain he must have felt to be able to do that in order to express himself, to relieve that burden he must have been under that none of us understood to the depth that we should have. And using this experience and having God bring Tara to this podcast today to share her experience and know that there is hope and there are resources for our survivors if they ever reach that point, I just want to let you guys know you are all worthy. You are going through a very huge struggle with cancer. It's a very scary disease. You have not deserved to get this disease. You have to suffer all of the side effects from the toxic treatments that we throw on you, and we celebrate your cure, but we don't really look at all the pain and suffering that you go through as a result of your cure. And I would think that every cancer survivor has dual feelings, both the feeling of being triumphant and feeling very satisfied, but also a despondency and a wish to end it in the sense that they don't feel the pain anymore. And I just want to let you know that there are people like Tara out there who are specialists. It's our job to recognize your pain and get you to people like Tara, get you to people who are in her organization to get the help that you need. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. Thank you for a very heavy and incredibly worthy podcast for our survivors. Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up, John Benzea. Mikey John Benzea, Charlotte Larson. See, my head is all crying inside me, right? Thank you to the board of directors for your direction. And of course, Tara McGuire for being an honored guest. I end this podcast like I end every single podcast. We wish you, our cancer survivors, a long, healthy, happy, and cancer-free life. And today we're going to add something. We want your pain to dissipate. We want you to feel that you're loved. We want you to feel that there's hope, and we want you to feel that there are people that can help you. God bless you. God be with you. Peace.